thanks very much for joining me. I'm Bob Franklin. You're listening to the Public Affairs Program, Like It Is. Gene Moore is guest hosting today's program.
The Tulsa, Oklahoma race riot of 1921, continuing my conversation with Mr. Tim Madigan by phone. Welcome back to University Forum.
Glad to be here again.
During our last conversation, we talked about how your book highlights the events and goes into a great deal of depth on the burning. And for those who did not hear that program, we might repeat that the burning of the Greenwood section of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was the burning by the white community of homes that were occupied by fairly well-to-do blacks in that era of 1921. Mr. Madigan, you developed this book as though it were a novel, and you have throughout the book pulled in the history of groups and individuals and some of the family background of many of the people involved. You also have touched on groups like the Ku Klux Klan. What part, if any, do you feel they had in precipitating this riot in 1921?
I feel that the Klan was central to what happened there. Even though the Klan was not officially organized in Tulsa until August of 1921. Interviews with various people over, in years past have made clear that the Klan was very active and popular in Tulsa beginning approximately 1918, and that by that time in the spring of 1921, was a major cultural force in Tulsa. And the mob proceeded I call it a chapter of my book is called A Single Ruthless Organism. Mm-hmm. And this mob of 10,000 people that wreaked such destruction on Tulsa proceeded with a kind of precision that it had to have been organized. And though no one has come forward, a Klan leadership or Tulsa city official has come forward or did come forward in the time afterward to say, I organized this or we organized this, I think that a very, very strong circumstantial case can be made for the fact that the Klan and the leadership of the Klan were instrumental in organizing the whites in the hours before this invasion of the black community began, and because there is the oral history and the testimony that there were groups of white people, white men, who were obviously leading the mob and recruiting for the mob in the restaurants and theaters all over Tulsa, and this, it's almost, it defies logic to say that the Klan wasn't involved because of what was going on both in Tulsa at that time and with the Klan generally in the United States.
I saw in your research some points that I certainly did not know, and that was the beginning of the Klan, which sounded as if it was just going to be a nice affiliative group, having a little fun, playing a little poker, and then expanding into all other areas. And, of course, ultimately we know what they are now even.
Well, the Klan in 1866 or 1867 was formed by a half dozen of disenchanted former rebel soldiers who were basically looking for a way to amuse themselves and stumbled into someone's linen closet and thought it was pretty funny to throw sheets over their heads and get on their horses and ride around, and everyone thought this was all hilarious, and so they continued doing it. But because of what was going on in the South at the time, and because the Southern white people were so enraged and disenchanted by what had happened in the Civil War, and that they had been disempowered, the Klan quickly grew into a vehicle for an expression of that and became this paramilitary force that murdered and terrorized not only blacks, but black sympathizers across the South to the extent that in 1871, federal legislation outlawed the Klan. By that time, and my take on things was that the Klan wasn't really necessary because the North had essentially turned its back on the blacks and on the South, and the Southern legislatures were free to enact Jim Crow legislation that mandated segregation. Lynching became a popular form of terrorizing blacks to keep them in their places. And then in 1915, and this is one of the things that I just think is incredible, the movie Birth of a Nation came out.
Oh, yeah.
Which, as I'm sure you know, invoked all the most hideous and vile racist stereotypes you can imagine in terms of the knuckle-dragging black buck chasing after the virginous white teenager. That certainly rings a bell in this case.
Mm-hmm.
It was a celebration of the Klan of the Reconstruction Era, the same Klan that had been outlawed by the federal government, but only and produced and directed by D.W. Griffith, who continues today to be seen as one of the great ancestors of contemporary filmmaking. It celebrated these stereotypes. It celebrated the Klan. The only problem was that it ran for 27 weeks alone in New York City, that it was previewed and endorsed by President Wilson and the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, that in the aftermath, people at the University of Chicago were having Klan parties, and New York society matrons in New York City were having Klan teas, and that the most popular Halloween costume for 10 years afterwards was the hood and the robe.
No one forget that the Klan was not limited just to the South, nor is it limited to the South today.
Well, that's exactly right. And, as a person who grew up in the North, there's a great temptation to kind of congratulate ourselves that we're so much more sophisticated and right-thinking in terms of the racial issues. But this is a great example of how that is not really the case, I don't think, and that we cannot congratulate ourselves. And
now, let's talk now a little bit about the media. We know that prior to the actual assault on the black community, that the press was involved. And there were two papers in that city at the time, were there not?
Yes, there were.
Yeah.
Two white papers.
Yeah. But the media, the white press at that time, you mentioned earlier in our last conversation that they were very wanting to, of course, sell papers, not too different than we are today.
Right.
Isn't this the time of what was emerging as a yellow journalism, the term that was being used?
Right.
So what did that press do that you think really touched off the torch?
There's a character in the book that I use almost as a metaphor for a lot of the things that were going on in the white community at the time. His name is Richard Lloyd Jones, who is the publisher of the Tulsa Tribune. Jones, interestingly enough, had been a writer for major New York magazines and had been published in a newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, before moving to Tulsa in 1919 to engage in a fairly spirited newspaper war with the Tulsa World, which was more conservative, more successful paper in Tulsa. Jones, ironically enough, and his father had been instrumental in establishing the birthplace of Abraham Lincoln as a national memorial, and traded heavily on that in his career for the rest of his life, talking about what a great man Lincoln was and how he had freed the slaves and how his name was sacred, et cetera, et cetera. Evidently failing to appreciate the irony that three blocks away from his office in Tulsa was the Greenwood community, in which many of those former slaves that Lincoln had freed now lived. The way Jones fought the newspaper war was in a way that is familiar to us today, by being sensational, by playing up the crime news, by running what it was what passed in those days as fairly prurient type material in terms of beauty pageants and whatnot, and by playing the race card, by writing about the black community, invoking these same kind of stereotypes that that were used in Birth of a Nation, and that when this young black was accused of assault on this elevator, but I think that Jones saw that as an opportunity to sell newspapers. The arrest of this black was not mentioned in the Tulsa World in the days after it happened. On the front page of the Tulsa Tribune, there was a news story that described what had happened or was alleged to have happened in that elevator in the most inflammatory terms, plus an editorial in which Jones himself was determined to weigh in on the matter. And as we talked last week, or in the last program, that editorial has since been disappeared from the archives, and then, in fact, there's a reward for it and by the Oklahoma Historical Society if anyone has a copy.
Is that right?
Yes. But the headline is remembered, and the headline said, "Two Lynch Negro Tonight." And that basically legitimized, because Richard Lloyd Jones was who he was, this devotee of Abraham Lincoln. That legitimized the actions of the white mob, and both legitimized the white mob and precipitated everything that was to follow, I think.
You're listening to University Forum. We're discussing Tulsa, the destruction of the black community, and a book aptly called The Burning by Tim Madigan. After the destruction of the community, we know that people were herded into different areas. Before that, though, before the destruction, there were blacks of different levels, just as there were in the white community, but physicians and morticians, and I believe one of the very outstanding black physicians was killed during the assault on the community. Isn't that right?
He was.
Dr. Jackson?
Dr. Jackson, yes. Dr. Andrew Jackson.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because the distancing of educated blacks from the so-called lower classes, there was that obviously a looking down also within the community itself. And I read one little article that I know you've read then in Mary Jones Parrish's book where she says, regardless of educational or financial advantages, a Negro was a Negro on that day and was forced to march with his hands up for blocks. It should teach us, remember, that we cannot rise higher than our weakest brother. Afterwards, then, how did they go about rebuilding the community?
Well, afterwards, the national press poured into Tulsa. And what happened there was on the front page of every major newspaper, white and black, for the next week. But 3 or 4 days after June 1st, a dam broke in Colorado, and a flood killed 300 people and essentially took Tulsa off the front pages. And it wouldn't return to the front pages for another 80 years in the national press. Locally, obviously, the recovery efforts, the aftermath, were, whether they liked to or not, were big news in the Tulsa newspapers. Well, what ended up happening within a couple of weeks of the burning, the Tulsa city officials passed an ordinance that effectively would have forbidden the Tulsa blacks from rebuilding in the places where their homes and businesses had been. And the idea was to push them further north out into the country so they could appropriate that land for warehouses and industrial complexes for the white community, which to this day has given rise to speculation and accusations in the black community that the destruction of Greenwood was actually a planned event to drive them into the country and allow the white community to take over their land. That's never been proven, but the accusation can certainly be understood given how Tulsa acted. When the national press was in town, the white leadership was all remorse. It seemed like the minute that the national press left town, then the tenor of things changed completely. the blacks were blamed for what happened. The white community tried to take advantage of what happened. The whites completely washed their hands in terms of the recovery effort and, in fact, refused donations from outside of Tulsa and turned the recovery effort over almost completely to the Red Cross. And it was only because of the fact that many of these leading black entrepreneurs, teachers, and business people had bank deposits in white banks in Tulsa that they had the wherewithal to rebuild. And within a year or so, the heart of Greenwood, at Greenwood and Archer, this thriving business community, had been rebuilt to look almost as it did before the riot. And in fact, that two-block area of North Tulsa still exists today, right there on the border of the railroad tracks.
The problem immediately afterwards, though, was this edict, that code that said that they couldn't rebuild unless they had a certain very stringent kind of building.
That's correct.
Yeah. And I understand that went to the courts. I do understand from Dr. Franklin that his father was involved in taking that up through the courts, to and that they reversed that, if I recall. Is that correct?
His father indeed was one of the lead lawyer that took this. It was a fire ordinance.
Yes.
It basically said that you had to rebuild in a certain way, in a way that would have been prohibitive to the people in Greenwood. And, of course, Mr. Franklin saw this, and others saw this for what it was, just an attempt to drive the black people out of Greenwood. They took the case to court and won and overturned this ordinance, which allowed the black people to begin rebuilding. The problem was that several crucial months had been lost, and winter was soon upon Tulsa, and thousands of people spent that winter in tents when they could have been back in some sort of more permanent shelter. But within a year, most of Greenwood had been built back up. I think that if you would have moved to Tulsa a year after it happened, there's a very good chance that you could have lived your whole life there without ever knowing that this thing had taken place in Greenwood.
Yeah, that brings me to another point. How difficult was it for you at the time that you did your research to get people to talk about what happened? I gather from the book that a number of people that you talked with were still very, very upset, even though this was that many years difference from the time that it took place.
One woman in particular, Eldoris McCondershy, who was a 10-year-old girl at the time and is now 90 and but a very vital 90-year-old person. When I went to her house in the spring of 2000, I believe it was, to talk to her about this, and she was one of the people who were flushed from her homes and joined this huge throng of refugees heading north into the country. Before she sat down to talk about it, she went over and she grabbed two pieces of tissue from where the tissues were in her book stand and said, "I know better than to talk about that day without having a few of these in my hand."
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed probably 15 or so the living survivors who were children when this happened. And fortunately, there had been other people in Tulsa, historians and private citizens, who had done some work in terms of preserving the oral histories of the people, particularly the black people, who had survived. And I availed myself of those things in court documents. But getting the white perspective was very, very difficult, and because the white did not talk about it. If they showed up at the emergency room or at the hospitals the day of the burning with bullet wounds or burns, they were quick to say that they were just innocent bystanders.
Were they afraid to talk about it, or did they just not want to say anything? What was it?
Well, I think in the white community, it was a combination of things. Most prominently, shame. I think that when the smoke had cleared, even the most racist Tulsan would probably have conceded to some extent that what had happened was wrong. Plus the fact that there is no statute of limitations on murder. And mm-hmm. I think that weighed heavily on Tulsans for decades after this had happened.
But they just don't, at this point, want to talk much about it, even now. Is that correct?
even now, I found very few white people in Tulsa who are willing to talk about it. A few people, but not many. And when the Tulsa Race Riot Commission was formed in 1997, for the first time, and this is 80 years after the event, for the first time, the commission investigators started hearing from white people. And most of these stories had been passed down second and third hand about what had happened and what they did. But until that time, the silence in Tulsa from the white community was virtually impenetrable. And since the book's been published, and I've done programs like this in other parts of the country, and particularly in the Southwest, people who grew up in Tulsa would call in, and they would say things like, "You know, I was born and raised in Tulsa, and my mother considered herself to be an amateur historian, but not once did this come up in our house." And these people who grew up in Tulsa feel a real sense of violation that they grew up in this community without knowing this had happened. Or they say, I was brought up and I studied it in Oklahoma schools or Tulsa schools, and when we were studying Oklahoma history, this event wasn't mentioned even.
Not in the history book.
Not
in the book. Now, you mentioned in the book that during the aftermath, a young white female reporter asked a 97-year-old former slave woman, "How could this happen?" And the response is, as you quote, "How could it not happen?"
Right.
Why do you think she responded that way, and what do you think was the cause? I know you've given it historical, but what do you think really made this happen?
In the cosmic sense, I think what made it happen was all the kind of poisonous currents that had been flowing through the South, particularly after the Civil War. As I studied this and started to learn about what was going on in the nation after the Civil War, right up to the 1960s, it seemed like Tulsa was inevitable, that the hatreds were so prevalent and the vulnerabilities of one community so acute that this was going to happen, and it did happen in cities across the country, as we spoke last time. Something of the level and magnitude of Tulsa was going to happen. It's like, as I say in the book, it's like all the hatreds and prejudices and paranoia that had been flowing through the country at that period in our history were somehow concentrated in this one place.
What did you hope to achieve by bringing this out? What's the purpose of people knowing about these kinds of confrontations and the conflagration that took place?
Well, this is what I hope will happen. I knew nothing or very little about black history. I was completely unaware of Tulsa until I started doing this work. And then I started learning about our history, our shared history, the history of African Americans in this country. And my life has been changed irrevocably. And as I say in the book, I cannot look at a black person the same way again. And I know that there are millions of other white people out there like me who just don't know. And I would hope that they would read the book and they would learn of the history. And I think that it explains somewhat the racial divide that still exists in this country. And I would hope that they would read this book and understand the history and see the history, and that in some small way their lives would be affected the same way mine has been by doing this research.
It's a powerful book, Mr. Tim Madigan. The St. Martin's Press, Thomas Dunn Books. It's a very, very powerful book. And I thank you so much for sharing this with our audience. Thank you for being my guest.
I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be a very special thanks to my friend Dr. Gene Moore for guest hosting the program. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.